Welcome to In Conversation With from the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce. Supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Presented by Stuart Elford. Recorded at Fresh Air Studios in Plymouth.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Elford, Chief Executive of Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce, with another edition of our In Conversation With podcast. My guest today has served as an MP for 32 years in Devon and was returned to Westminster in 2019 with a majority of over 21,000. He was knighted in the New Year's Honours in 2019. He's been a supporter of business, the Chamber, and me personally. And I should add, though, of course, that the Chamber is apolitical, so we'll be talking a bit about his life in politics rather than policies, although we may touch on that. So please welcome Sir Gary Streeter. Thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure, Stuart.
And I think that you're the first knight I've had in the studio.
I've parked the horse outside.
Yes, I was expecting a suit of armour and a large sword and everything.
Only at the weekends.
Yes. So 32 years in politics. Wow, you must have some stories. Where did it all start? Because you trained as a solicitor, didn't you?
Yes, I was a partner in the Plymouth law firm, then called Foote & Bowden, and now Foote & Anstey.
Foote & Anstey, yeah.
And I knew nothing about politics. I wasn't involved at university. And really, it's basically because I'm a committed Christian. And during the year 1985, which many of your listeners weren't even born, I'm sure, I had this sense of a calling to serve, if you like, in the public realm. And it sort of materialized into a tap on the shoulder to get involved in the political world, which I did from about December 85 onwards, and been there ever since.
Well, I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Funnily enough, that's something I wanted to talk to you about, if that's all right. But just to touch on the, you've been married to Janet for 46 years?
46 years in July, don't exaggerate.
45 and a half. Does she get a long service or a long suffering medal? Or both?
She's hoping for time off for good behaviour.
Yeah.
Look, it's the most wonderful thing in the world, a happy marriage. And I've been blessed with that throughout my entire life.
Yeah, lucky you. I had a very unhappy one, so it was quite short.
But I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. It's quite funny. But I'm in awe of people who can have that lovely committed relationship. I wish I had it. And I was going to come on to the fact that you said you're a committed Christian. Has that helped you in your political career? I mean, it sounds like it was the start of your political career.
It's the reason I'm involved in it, because actually when I started, I knew nothing about politics and it took a lot of learning. And in a way, politics, where you're trying to promote yourself and your ideas, is the antithesis of what being a humble Christian is supposed to be about. Not many of us achieve that, of course. But nonetheless, the reality is that politics is about everything. It's about making decisions about, you know, when we go to war, how we look after sick and elderly people and so on. It's about everything. So why shouldn't men and women of faith and values be involved in that process? And in the last 25 to 30 years, more Christians are getting involved, not for any sort of theological blueprint, but just public service to make the country better.
That's very interesting, because you've touched on a couple of things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, firstly, the world of politics can be incredibly unkind at times, can't it? I mean, personal attacks and things. How do you reconcile that with Christianity?
Yeah, well, it's brutal. Politics is brutal. And I think one of the reasons why our country had a difficult sort of second half of the 20th century is most Christians in the 20th century after the First World War said it's too mucky, too dirty, we can't be involved in that. And actually, I think a lot of good people didn't get involved. But the reality is that, you know, you have to learn your trade. You can't probably ever remember me publicly insulting anyone, because I hope I haven't done that.
No.
I very rarely do party politics. It's always about the community. Always try and play the issue, not the man. And I think we can demonstrate, you know, that you can disagree well. And so I've got very strong Christian friends in the Labour Party.
Yeah.
And we sometimes have debates across the chamber, but we disagree well.
Yeah.
And I hope that's helpful for others to think about that.
I think that's a really good way to look at it. One of my best friends has a completely different view to me on Brexit. I mean, completely different. And we just don't talk about it. It's okay. He's still a nice guy. I still love him.
Yeah.
I think he loves me. It's fine. Yeah. But we just don't go down there, because that is just something we will never fundamentally agree on. And sort of on from that really a bit, how do you reconcile the fact that some of government policy can appear unchristian at times? I'm supposing the thing with Rwanda at the moment, on the face of it, looks very unwelcoming and very sort of unchristian. So how do you reconcile that sort of thing?
I think I would want to unpick, but it would take a long time, the word unchristian.
Okay, sorry.
I mean, it does seem harsh.
Harsh,
I accept
the word.
That. Okay, it seems harsh. But the reality is this, that we have a massive problem of illegal migration.
Mm.
And quite a few of us have come to the conclusion that a deterrent is necessary to stop the people smugglers persuading people to pay them their money to come from a safe country, France, to cross that channel in perilous, small, leaky little boats to get to the UK. And I think that if we can get that policy in place, I don't feel comfortable with it, although there are other countries in the world that have their asylum system processed in a third party country. And though I wouldn't have invented it, I don't feel comfortable with it. I know that we need a deterrent. And this is what my government, my party have come up with. I'm therefore supporting it. I think it will work. And I think the reason why we're seeing the numbers sort of increase at the moment is people are trying to get across here before the deterrent's in place. Because right. The reality of the deterrent is this. If they come here and they are put on that plane to Rwanda and their asylum claim is successful, they don't get to come to the UK. They get to stay in Rwanda. That's a very big deterrent. And therefore, I hope more people who are fleeing persecution will apply for asylum in the first safe country they come to, rather than trekking all the way over to the UK.
Yeah. So you think we've been a bit of a soft touch, or seen as a good place to be an asylum seeker?
I think the language has got something to do with it. A lot of people are learning English because they're watching American TV shows on their smartphones from the countries they come from, because everyone's got a smartphone these days.
Yeah.
Let's remind ourselves, Germany and France take more asylum seekers than we do. They have many more applications than we do. My point is that this is really not people legitimately claiming asylum. This is illegal migration, and it needs to have a deterrent put in place, and that's what we're trying to do. So I support it.
Okay. And you've served as a minister. Was that a privilege, a pain, a mixture of both? How did it feel? I kind of wonder, what would I do if I sat around that table? I mean, you sat in Downing Street, I assume. You've had meetings with prime ministers. And how does that feel?
Well, my initial reaction was, surely there's a room somewhere that I haven't discovered yet full of very clever people running the country. Surely it can't be left to people like me. And then you find, oh, heck, it is.
Yeah.
I loved being a minister. I was a whip in the John Major's government months first, and I loved that. I mean, it was a crisis every day. My first parliament, about 3 years in, we had a majority of about three. So every vote was a cliffhanger, but I loved that. And the camaraderie is fantastic. And then I became a minister in the Lord Chancellor's department. And the thing about that is that my boss, if you like, was in the House of Lords. He was a Lord Chancellor. So I was the only Commons minister. So I had to do all the question time on my own. And I remember when Dennis Skinner, remember him, the Beast of Bolsover, he's completely knocked my middle stump out one day by, I'm standing there and I've briefed myself on everything that anyone could possibly ask me. And in his broad, was it Lancashire or Yorkshire, forgive me, accent, he just said this, why shouldn't judges, I think, what's coming, be elected? And then sat down. Well, I've never given that a moment's thought in my entire life. And if you went back to Hansard of my answer to that question, I think I probably spent an hour and a half saying absolutely nothing.
Right.
So I loved it, but there were moments of thinking, oh, I didn't do that very well.
Yeah. It reminds me of, so in previous life, I was a press officer, and actually I loved someone asking me a really difficult question because it made you really, like the swan thing where you have to look calm on the front, but underneath you're paddling like fury to try and get a sensible answer out.
Well, I didn't achieve it on that. And another little ditty was that I'm not particularly aggressive, but if someone comes aggressive at me, I tend to push back in the same kind. And I remember one day an MP on the other side asked me a question. I pushed back quite firmly. I thought Betty Boothroyd, wonderful speaker, called me over at the end of the session and said, Gary, come here. Hi, Madam Speaker. He said, look, you must remember when you're at the dispatch box, you are a minister of Her Majesty the Queen. Do you think Her Majesty would have liked you to have spoken to the honourable gentleman like that? I said, no, not really. I'm very sorry.
What would the Queen say? Yes.
I went away with a tail between my legs.
She was quite a force of nature, wasn't she, Betty Boothroyd?
Oh, she was wonderful.
Yeah.
Best speaker I've served under. She was very fair, but she had that touch of glamour. It was wonderful.
Who are the most interesting characters you met in politics, do you think?
Well, a lot of interesting people.
That's what I meant. That was a politely phrased phrase. Interesting.
I'll tell you who I think. It sounds quite boastful, but I rarely meet people who I think are absolutely on a different level, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Absolutely superior. And I've met three or four at Westminster. And if I'm honest, and I'll start because I'm fair-minded, Tony Blair, I think, was on a different level.
Was he?
He had everything. Right. David Cameron, everything to be a great leader.
Yeah.
I would add two other people. William Hague was probably the best prime minister we didn't have.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant man. And some of your listeners won't agree with this, won't believe me. Rishi Sunak is also special. If we don't have all the nonsense that we've had in the last two or three years from the pantomime of the Boris Johnson years, if people give him a chance, the guy's got so much to offer.
Funnily enough, when I first saw him speak, I did say to my brother, I said, what do you think of our new prime minister then? And he wasn't prime minister. He was a junior minister because I'd seen him and I thought he did have something.
Something about it.
And sometimes I kind of feel sorry for politicians who have come to power at the wrong time. You know, I look at Barack Obama, who on the day he came to office and had all these incredible ideas of things he wanted to do, was told you can't because the country's in a terrible state and there's no money
there's
and
no
it's
money.
All falling apart. And I think, God, poor guy. But then I also think, who better could you have had to take a country through the crisis at that time than that person? So, yeah.
No, he was great, Barack Obama. But Richie is special. If you're the smartest guy in the room, whichever room you walk into, you've got an edge, haven't you?
Well, you do, although there's that saying that if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. And I quite like that sort of being challenged. You know, I like someone to ask me a difficult question.
Yeah.
And there's a story, I don't know if this is true, about a young politician who was invited into the cabinet to speak about something and told Margaret Thatcher she was wrong. And apparently there was quite a feisty exchange. Mm. And on the way out, several politicians were saying to this person, yeah, that's your career over, you don't stand up to Maggie. And Dennis Thatcher put his arm around him and said, she'll have loved that. Yeah. And it was John Major.
Well, there you are.
Yeah. And who became Prime Minister.
He did.
And she loved a bloody good argument.
Oh, she did.
Yeah.
I think the best people do. The best people surround themselves with even better people if they can find them.
Well, that's what I love about Barack Obama. I don't know if you've read his book, but he talks about how he realized he could win an argument even when he's wrong because he's eloquent and intelligent. Mm. So he surrounds himself by people who will tell him he's wrong.
Yeah.
Unlike Donald Trump, who will surround himself by people who tells him he's right.
Yeah.
And I find that extraordinary. You need people to say, hang on a minute, mate, calm it down.
Yeah, I mean, Ronald Reagan, I think, also was a great communicator, but not a great brain, but he surrounded himself with very good people.
Yeah.
And that's the way, I think, to do leadership. What a pity it is, isn't it, in our modern world, that Trump versus Biden is the best that America can offer us, and they are still the leaders of the free world.
Yeah. 2 points on that. One is, I didn't think about this until recently when a friend of mine said, Americans, it's not that they want to choose Trump or Biden. They don't actually want either of them. They want a better choice.
Of course they do.
They've got no choice. And I didn't really understand that. But the other thing you said there, why do they call him the leader of the free world? He's not my leader.
No, but
I find that really, that's sort of American arrogance thing, isn't it? Or is it just because they're powerful and they've got the biggest stick?
Forgive me for using a phrase which probably originated in France, realpolitik.
Right.
The reality of this world is for the last, 70 years since the Second World War, that unless America was going to do it, it didn't happen.
Right.
And that's why our alliance with the US is so important militarily, but also in diplomatic terms. They are still the leaders of the free world. And maybe in 10 years' time, China and so on, it will be a very different world when we have China dominating. But I think the US, UK, Western alliance is still, that's the only thing that can get good things done in the world.
Right.
Although, of course, mistakes have been made, and I believe in it. But, you know, with that kind of leadership, it's looking a bit thin at the moment.
Yeah. Talking about things going on in the world, I mean, what do you make of the Middle East at the moment? Oh, I almost can't watch the news without feeling utter despair that we seem to be going back to the dark ages.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Israel-Palestine 4 times as a parliamentarian. And I've sat down with Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian leaders over the years. Because at one stage, I had the shadow international development brief for the Conservative Party and so on. And you start talking to, particularly if I'm going to say to the Palestinians about, well, come on, look, starting from where we are today, what can we do to move this forward?
Yeah.
And they say, oh, no, Balfour Declaration, 1944, you know, oh, no, it's 50 years ago. No, no, starting from where we are, looking forward, they can't do it. It's always got to look back and say, oh, no, they were wrong 50 years ago. Britain was wrong. America was wrong, so on. And I'm afraid, therefore, I came away after about the fourth time saying, I just can't think there's a solution. Until people are starting to say, we draw a line now and look forwards, not backwards, I don't think there's a real solution. But we've got to keep on trying, of course.
You think that's a cultural thing in the Middle East, that they hark back to old adversaries? And
I mean, we're all inclined to do it. And when I had a proper job as a solicitor, I had plenty of clients, you know, involved in disputes. It's sort of, well, just let that go. You know, for goodness,
go,
I can't
let it go.
You know, and of course, it's well known that, you know, sort of revenge is taken in third or fourth generations and so on, particularly in sort of certain parts. I don't think it's a Middle Eastern thing. I think it's a human thing. But it's just a pity that it continues to cause terrible conflict and suffering in such a delicate part of the world.
Mm. I remember, funny enough, a lawyer saying to me, don't do what's worse for your adversary, do what's best for you. Because sometimes people just want to attack at all costs, and actually that isn't helpful to themselves.
I believe I created that phrase about 20 years ago, Stuart.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, maybe it was you that said it to me.
I've been saying it to clients all the way through. Don't think about what's worse for them. Write what's best for you.
Well, not a subject I want to talk about on the podcast, but that's when you helped me. So it genuinely might have been you, because I remember being in dispute with my then employers, the Devon and Cornwall Constabulary, and you were incredibly kind and helpful to me. And is the only reason I'm mentioned in Hansard, because you asked a question about it, because it was a scandal. But I think it probably was you then that said that, and it's stuck with me ever since.
The reality is, you know, sometimes we've all got to let things go and get on with our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I was very angry about that for many years, and I woke up, I mean, we're recording this in Fresh Air Studios just outside Royal William Yard, and I had a flat in Royal William Yard, and I remember to this day waking up still angry about it, like 4 years later, five years later. And my little epiphany moment was the only person in the world who cares about this now and who is hurting is me.
Yeah.
And I've just got to let it go.
Yeah.
And I felt better from that day.
That's good.
Was it Maya Angelou? I think was might not have been, but to forgive is to set a prisoner free and realise the prisoner was you.
Absolutely.
Just let it go.
Yeah, let it go.
So do you think there's a solution out there, or are we just got to let them get on with it?
Well, I think we don't let them get on with it. We try through all measures and means, diplomacy, sometimes, you know, soft power, hard power, aid, and so on. We do our best to contain it at the very least.
Mm. Because I can understand after the awful attack on Israel why they responded, but then I can also see the response seems apocalyptic.
Disproportionate.
Disproportionate is the polite word, yes.
A lot of constituents, you know, are angry with me, for example, and angry with the UK government for not sorting it out. Israel will only listen to one person in the world, and that's the President of the United States of America. And as we know right now, they're barely listening to the President of the United States of America, and their support is critical for the future survival of Israel. I think you've got to bear in mind, every day Israel's fighting for its survival. That's the first thing. Secondly, it is a democracy. Thirdly, that there are neighbouring states which are sworn to wipe it off the face of the earth. You know, they have to be on their guard.
Yeah.
It was obvious, wasn't it, from October onwards, they were always going to overreact.
Mm.
But, you know, we're all doing our utmost to bring people around the table and find a sustainable long-term peace.
It's a very, very sad thing. Mm. I mean, on another sort of international note, you voted against Brexit, didn't you? And, I mean, some have described Brexit as a massive act of self-harm and have said that we are the only country that have ever imposed trade sanctions on ourselves. You must have been very disappointed with that as a result. And since, I mean, you must be seeing constituents coming to you with issues, especially businesses who trade internationally, and you've got a background in that, so you understand it. Well, how do you feel about it now? What's the answer?
I mean, I was shocked and disappointed by the result. We always said to the British people, if you vote for it, we will deliver it. So the next day, I had absolutely no doubt that we have to deliver it constitutionally.
Oh, yeah.
There would have been riots and all the rest of it if we hadn't. So how's it going? I think we had quite a hard Brexit. We didn't need to do that. I think there are two areas of particular concern. One is the trading situation, as you say, with our nearest neighbour and some of the lack of wealth as a result of that, but also travel opportunities for young people, musicians, people who previously were just coasting around, and what a great thing that was, you know, and I feel for people that that's not the same anymore. Having said all of that, the reality is we are a great country. We can make this work. I think we are in the process of making this work. There are some wins from the Brexit decision. And as time goes by, I think those wins will get greater. If you said, was Brexit a mistake? Too soon to judge. Maybe historians in 20 years' time will say, well, they'll debate it, of course, but maybe it's something that, you know, we can make work. And that's
got no choice, really, have we?
We've got absolutely no choice. I think that, you know, if we have a Labour government after the next election, and of course all the polls are telling us that we will, I think there will be some tinkering with the trading arrangements, which might make things better. But then, of course, the purists will say, oh, but that's going back on a tough Brexit, and we'll have those arguments all over again.
Don't think we'll ever end up rejoining.
Not in the next, decade or two, but never say never.
No.
I mean, I remember when we won the 92 election against all the odds, John Major won the 92 election against all the odds, everyone said the Labour Party is finished. It will never form a government again. And in 97, they had the biggest majority in their history.
Yeah.
Never say never.
No, not quite.
The conversation continues shortly. But first, the 60-second charity pitch.
Hi, I'm Jackie from the Alice Cross Centre, a vibrant, warm welcome community centre in Tynmouth with activities and events for all ages, from a memory cafe for people with dementia to a wonderful youth choir. We run some vital support services to help with the cost of living crisis, affordable food and alleviating social isolation, including a meal delivery service for over 60s, where it is free for people on a low income, a community cafe on a donate what you can basis, and a grief support group. We have loads of fun activities like fitness classes and social events. So if you are in Tynmouth, pop in for a cuppa and say hello. I'd love to show you around and I look forward to meeting you. Thank you.
Follow the Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce on X at @chamber_Devon and search for us on LinkedIn. Make sure you don't miss out on future episodes. Hit subscribe now. In Conversation With, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors. Now, back to the conversation.
Barack Obama says the arc of history is long. You don't look at the small and, you know, minute by minute, you've got to look at it as long.
You've obviously just finished reading his book, Stuart.
Well, no, it just stuck with me. I just think he's an incredible guy.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, genuinely, I've tried to read his second book, The Political Manifesto. I don't understand it. I mean, I'm not that politically astute to understand it. So it's not from a political point of view.
Right.
It's just from his style, his personality. Yeah. There's not been a hint of scandal around him.
No.
He is clearly a decent guy who wants to do some good and seems like an incredibly good leader.
Yeah.
You know, one of those, as you say, who's a step above.
I agree. And I happened to be in Africa the day that he was elected as president.
Wow.
So the first black president of the United States of America. And for everyone I met, they were in the bars watching it on the television. For them, it was a game changer. You know,
yeah.
We can do it. We can make the highest level. It was a pretty significant moment for the world.
About three things happened at that time. I remember thinking, that's just so good to show the opportunities for black people. And one of them was that. And the other one, I think, was Lewis Hamilton won the world championship in the same year, I think.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, good.
Yeah.
There's some real role models now, because there was a lack of that, I think. And that was good. So I do want to touch on a slightly thorny subject, I suppose, that I'm sure you've seen a lot in your career and have served a very long time yourself without any scandals that I know of. But politics has faced some awful scandals recently, hasn't it? We've had MP expenses, Partygate, PPE, sexual misconduct affairs, rapid changes of prime minister after catastrophic financial decisions. And all of this from an organisation of 650 people. And if that was a business, it would go out of business straight away, wouldn't it? So do you think trust in politicians is at an all-time low, and can it be regained?
Well, first of all, I would say, let's remind ourselves that with all of this going on, and the expenses scandal was 2010, it's seared into my memory. But as you say, some of the things recently in the pantomime that was surrounding Boris Johnson, let's just remind ourselves that our democracy remains robust in this country, and the people have an opportunity to sort it out if they want to at the next election. If at the next election the Labour Party win, the Conservative Party will vacate government. There are many countries in the world where you lose an election, you stay there.
Yeah.
So thank goodness for that. Secondly, politics attracts colourful, charismatic, risk-taking people.
Right.
And so you're always going to have a disproportionate number of people doing stupid things. And then if you take into account, for most of us who are, my constituents, 4 hours from Westminster, however you do it, until I get my helicopter, you're away from your family.
Yep.
You have late nights. You're surrounded by a lot of young people of both sexes, attractive young people. There's alcohol, you know, every dinner, the wine is flowing, and then there's bars aplenty. It's a bit of a recipe for disaster, really. I'm not trying to excuse it. I'm not excusing it. It's deeply disappointing. But that's the reality of it. So politicians are still human beings. We perhaps do more than our fair share of daft things. But on the other hand, don't forget we are doing it all under a spotlight. Mm. And almost certainly everything that a member of parliament has done stupidly in the last 10 years has come out one way or another in the press. Lots of your listeners will be saying, well, do you know what? I did something stupid when I was... When I was 17, Stuart, here we are. This is me speaking now. Mm. When I was 17, I passed my driving test and my best buddy Steve and I raced through Tiverton, where we were at school. I was in my Ford Anglia and he was in his Morris 1100. And we were racing through Tiverton. How stupid is that? And I went the wrong way around the roundabout because I thought it would give me the edge to get ahead of him. Now, if I'd hit someone, my life would have been completely different. Mm. I was really stupid thing to do. But fortunately, I didn't hit anyone. And I went on to be the brilliant man that I am today. So I think what I'm trying to say is, yeah, it's true. It's disappointing. We are human beings. We are living under a spotlight. Everyone out there listening to this has done something really stupid in their lives. I think, well, thank goodness that didn't get on the front page of the Daily Telegraph. Mm.
Well, I always say, thank God I did my growing up before social media, where it's permanently kind of recorded every silly thing you did, every drunken party. I think most people will forgive human things, the sort of thing you talked about, you know, in the same way that apparently the French have this view that politicians can philander and have affairs as long as they don't campaign on holy values of, you know, family and what have you.
Yeah.
I think it's the stuff like the PPE where it just looks like mates are getting millions of pounds while other people are suffering with the cost of living and stuff like that. That seems truly immoral.
Yeah, I agree, but I'm not justifying it, and I don't know the detail. But what I would say is two things. One, remember back to the early days of the pandemic. You couldn't get PPE for love nor money. We were absolutely desperate. We, you know, doctors, nurses screaming on the television screens every day, where's the PPE? Where's the PPE? You know, we're dying here. So people did make decisions outside the box. Maybe they shouldn't have done, but that's the reason behind it. Secondly, we have in place a system of checks and balances. You know about those things. Mm. They've been in the press. They're subject to an inquiry. if there is wrongdoing, there will be punishment. So, yeah, things went wrong. Things do go wrong. But some people say, oh, we live in such a corrupt country. Our politics is corrupt. It is not corrupt. Any hint of corruption is exposed. There's checks and balances. You know, judges don't take bribes. Ministers don't take bribes in our countries. And I think for two-thirds of the world, that is not the case. No, so let's just for one moment think, actually, you know, it's not great, but we do live in a great country.
Yeah, I spent 17 years in the police service. And in that time, despite hearing lots of people saying, oh, there's corruption in the police, I was in Devon and Cornwall Police. I knew of two corrupt officers.
Yeah.
And everyone pointed at them and said, they're corrupt, get them out.
Yeah.
And, you know, there seemed to be this obsession in the press and in the public that all police officers are corrupt. Utter nonsense. They're all trying to do the right thing.
Absolutely.
I do remember, it just reminds me of a story. I saw, it was Peter Hain was on Question Time once, and a lady in the audience gave him an absolute beasting about the fact he'd been minister when a confectionery company had said, if you collect enough wrappers, we'll provide sports equipment for schools. And they'd signed it off. And of course, the tabloids had got hold of this and worked out that to get a set of goalposts, you'd have to make 100 children obese or something, you know, some such thing. I mean, I'm exaggerating. And this lady ripped into him and said, how can you possibly justify that? Best answer I've heard. He just said, I can't. It was a ridiculous decision. He said, I'm just sorry. All I can say, and it's not an excuse, we were under intense pressure. We were trying to deliver. We didn't have enough money. Someone suggested something that it looked like it meant kids got school equipment, you know, we sports equipment. We just went for it, but we didn't do our due diligence. It was a ridiculous decision. I'm really sorry. And the whole audience went, okay, fair enough. Yeah. You could just see, if people own up and just say, yeah, I made a stupid decision because I did it in a hurry.
We don't do that enough in politics. I completely agree.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the systematic thing. We haven't got time to talk about it now, but everything seems to be, if you're blue, you have to hate everything red does. If you're red, you have to hate everything that blue does and in between. And actually, there's some decent people trying to do decent things. And when we look, I mean, a microcosm of that in Plymouth is the Box. Cross-party support, we get the Box built. It's amazing. You know, Arts Council England says one of the most significant cultural events in a decade is the Box.
Right.
And that was cross-party. Yeah. You know, I just sometimes think, can you not all agree on...
There's a lot of strong cross-party relationships. And on the select committees and on the bill committees and so on, which I do a lot of chairing of, there's a lot of cross-party working. The reality is we have an adversarial system.
Yeah.
And when we all agree, we normally make bad law. The idea is government brings forward a notion, a policy, and the opposition's job is to probe it, sharpen it. I mean, sometimes it's ridiculous. Prime Minister's questions is just stupid. It's just theatre, tit-for-tat nonsense. And I don't go in very often because I can't bear it. But most of the House of Commons, it doesn't work like that most of the time. We are being grown up, serious, saying, how can we solve this problem?
Mm. And are there enough young people getting involved in politics? Good young people who want to come in for the right reasons?
Yeah, I mean, to my utter amazement,
yeah,
a lot of people still want to get involved in politics, a lot of talented young people. I mean, I'm not keen on the impact that social media has made on politics, and in particular, how a lot of female MPs get very badly bullied and abused on social media.
Yeah, that is outrageous.
It is utterly outrageous. What's going on out there with some of our men? I don't know. But nonetheless, it's a noble calling. You can't have a democracy without elected representatives. A lot of bright young things still want to do it. First of all, it's a great job in itself. I've loved most of the last 32 years, and particularly the constituency work and the kind of respect that flows in both directions in all the stuff I've done in the constituency is wonderful. But, you know, if you're a David Cameron or a William Hague or a Tony Blair and you float to the surface, imagine being the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom for 8 years or 10 years or something. What a privilege. You know, how much change you could bring about. Yeah, politics is still a noble and attractive calling despite the shortcomings.
Funny, I was on my questions, so it's got the word privilege. What's been the biggest privilege of your career? I guess I'm thinking about who you've been lucky enough to meet.
Yeah, well, I've done a lot of travelling because I've held some sort of international posts and I've enjoyed that very much indeed. I have met some great people. But if I'm honest, the real privilege is, so I walk into, well, it happened last Friday. I don't like going shopping with my wife for food, if I'm honest. But sometimes I do.
Many people do.
No. And I was in at Aldi and a lady came up to me and grabbed me by the arm and said, oh, Gary, you don't know who I am, but you helped me and my daughter, I won't name her daughter, many years ago, and it's worked out so well. And blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, I'm getting very emotional. And she started crying. So I won't say people cry on my shoulder every week, but every week when I'm pottering around the constituency, not necessarily doing MP things, just doing me things, someone will come up to me and say, oh, thank you so much for helping me 10 years ago, or my uncle, or my mother, or whatever. And you think, what a privilege to have been in that position where you could help people. And that's what I will take out of this.
Yeah. What's your biggest success, do you think? Is there something you're really proud you achieved or had a part of? You go, what's
yes,
that?
And it happened in the first 12 months. And if you can't think of it, then I'm going to get very cross with you. The decision had been made that the Trident refit work would go to Rosyth.
Yeah.
And David Jameson, the Labour MP for Devonport, and I got together and said, we're not having this. And Devonport Management Limited, as it was in those days, put together a campaign. The whole of the Plymouth community got behind the campaign. And David and I, and because it was a Conservative government making this decision, particularly myself, lobbied every cabinet minister, speeches in the Commons, wrote to everybody. And in the end, but only because we had the best business case, but also we were lobbying furiously, the decision was made to bring that contract to Devonport. Rosyth had already dug the dry dock out, ready to go. So that's probably created millions and millions of pounds every year into our local economy and thousands of jobs, both direct and indirect. Unfortunately for me, it happened in my first 12 months. I still think...
Has it all gone downhill from there?
I've done nothing good since then.
I'm sure that's not true.
It was fabulous because it's meant we've brought an awful lot of wealth to this area, and it was the right decision for the country, but also a great decision for Plymouth.
Yeah. Sorry, it just reminded me that the former Director General of British Chambers of Commerce, Dr. Adam Marshall, lovely man, he was telling us as he left that he joined as the financial crisis hit and he left as the pandemic hit, or he took us through the pandemic. And I said, oh, great. So you've basically taken us from one disaster to another. So, you know, that is a significant thing you've done. Has some of it been fun? Have you had a laugh at times? I mean, can you remember things you think, God, that was good. I enjoyed that. That was a real laugh.
I think you have to, otherwise you go crazy.
Yeah.
I do a lot of mentoring these days, and I'm pleased about that for young MPs from all parties, particularly Christian MPs. And I always say to them, you know, one way to survive this place, you need a buddy. A buddy you can go off for a pizza with and, you know, be silly with and have a couple of beers and be a bit silly with. Trusting environment. It's not going to talk to the Telegraph about it the next day.
Yeah.
But I do remember one incident where my closest friend in politics, and he still is, he's in the House of Lords, but we meet once a fortnight at least for a pizza and a laugh. We went up to Chinatown one night in the first parliament. It must have been about 94-ish. And we came back and the whips were waiting for us and saying, oh, quick, into the chamber, quick. We need to keep this debate going for goodness knows what reasons. Yeah. It's about 11:30 already. It used to be like that in those days. And we didn't even know what the debate was. And we got in there and found out it was a debate about EU natural habitats or something. So I ended up making a speech about some kind of mythical spider in my constituency. And he kept intervening. The job was only to keep it going for another 30 minutes so that the vote wouldn't come before midnight or something like that. And if you go back to Hansard in those days, it is absolute rubbish. And then from time to time, Hansard records interruption, and that was me giggling.
Right.
So I'm making a speech, and I guess can't help myself. All right, I've probably had a couple of glasses of wine. I mean, your listeners are going to be horrified, aren't they?
No.
It's just nonsense. But we did the job. We kept the debate going till 12 o'clock, and then there was a vote, and we won it, or whatever.
It reminds me of seeing, you know, at the end of question time, they always ask a sort of slightly light-hearted question if they've got, you know, a minute or two left. And they asked Tony Benn, do you think people are fed up of politicians speaking without really saying anything? And he said, well, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at this from both sides, and he spoke for about 2 minutes without saying anything, and it was a matter of brilliance.
He is a brilliant man. You just
look and go, that's clever. You've learned how to completely avoid answering the question.
He was a brilliant man, and his son Hillary is a clever man as well.
Yeah. What's the best bit of advice you were given? Or is there something you'd go back and change? Or if you were to give advice now to someone coming through, what would it be?
I mean, I was given good advice in the first 12 months or so by a Plimstock city councillor called David Viney.
Oh, yeah.
And I was making a speech after, you know, I've been elected a few months, and of course everyone expects you to know everything. And I think I was trying to speak like William Hague, or, you know, I was trying to speak like Winston Churchill, let's say.
Oh, you're trying to be a big orator.
I was trying to be a big orator, and it just wasn't working at all. And he came up to me afterwards and said, Gary, look, we all love you. You're going to be a star, but you've got to learn, just be yourself.
Right.
It's good enough. We selected you. You've been elected. Just be yourself. Don't try to be anyone else. And I thought, well, blow me down with a feather. He's absolutely right. And I've tried very hard after that to be myself.
To be yourself.
Not always. You know, sometimes we put on airs and graces, don't we? And that's the advice I would give anyone else. Because I think the key thing that works in politics is authenticity.
Yeah.
If you're real, doesn't matter what you believe, actually. If it's really what you believe, people will accept it.
Conviction,
I agree with
politics,
it.
As opposed to, yeah.
Authenticity. Be real. Be yourself.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important. It just reminded me of Yes Minister with Paul Eddington. Occasionally would grab his lapels, wouldn't he, and start talking like this, you know, and then you're trying to be Churchill.
Yes.
And that was brilliant, wasn't it? Because that did reflect what was actually going on in politics.
Well, when I got to be a minister just for 12 months, Yes Minister was very insightful, put it that way. They saw me coming, you know, they kept me busy.
Well, I think allegedly they had people inside government that were feeding them sort of lines and subjects that made so real.
I mean, it's
just incredible. What do you love most about Devon?
I was raised in Devon on a dairy farm just outside Tiverton. So I love the nature, the countryside. Mm. I love the people. I love the slightly easier way of life than it is in London. I love the coastline. I mean, my favourite thing is first thing in the morning when I'm home is walking the dogs. Mm-hmm. We've got a few acres. My wife's got horses. Just enjoying, if you like, I'm going to put it my way, not your way, enjoying God's creation.
Mm.
You know, walking under the trees and watching the squirrels and the dog chase the squirrel and the pigeons and just love being outside in this beautiful part of the world.
Yeah. And you're going to do a bit more of that, I suspect, because you're standing down after all this time.
Thank goodness for that.
Really? What caused that decision? I mean, you just feel... Enough's enough?
Enough's enough. I'll be 69. Probably the next election won't be till November. I'm 69 on the 2nd of October. I'm sure the cards will now start flooding in. And I think it's time to give a younger person a go. And the person who's been selected, I won't name her, but she's going to be brilliant. So it's time for me to spend some time with my wife. The real sacrifice in politics is people married to politicians. Mm. It's the worst job in the world. We can't go out for a dinner without someone wandering over to the table and say, oh, Gary, just about...
And it's okay to just come up and do that.
Just say, my fork is halfway to my mouth. Oh, just about, you know, Brexit or, you know, Gaza. Maybe not now. So we're looking forward to some easier years, just pottering around, maybe going away, you know, long weekends and stuff. Yeah, now's the time.
Right. I only have one final question. I'm sorry to drop this on you, but I have actually discovered a scandalous, embarrassing fact about you, and I'm sorry to raise it, but I have it on strong authority that your favourite film is Pretty Woman.
Yeah. Have I got to resign early?
Yeah, that's it. What's that about? You're an old romantic.
I am a total romantic.
Are you?
I mean, I can remember the time and the day that I saw Jan for the first time across the crowded dance floor in Tiverton. She can't even remember the date of our anniversary. I'm a sold-out romantic. I love romantic comedies, rom-coms, and Pretty Woman, I think, is the best one there is. And, and I've watched it, I should think, at least a dozen times, and I still cry at the same bits every time.
Can you imagine in Downing Street the sort of Love Actually scene of dancing away with Hugh Grant?
I definitely can. That's another brilliant film.
Yeah.
I can see not every Prime Minister would behave like that, but I can see some of the younger ones would.
Yes, I think there's some great lines in that. Doesn't he look at the painting of Margaret Thatcher and he calls her a saucy minx, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
And was that your experience of Margaret Thatcher? Because you met her, didn't you?
I met her a few times. No, I don't think I could.
You wouldn't describe her as a saucy minx.
I would describe her as terrifying as a young member of parliament. I sat beside her at dinner once and, I was quite intimidated, if I'm honest. She was very impressive, but she was very fixated as she got towards the end of her career on her views. Deep with her views. And of course, we didn't realise at the time she was already becoming not very well.
Okay, the start of dementia. Mm. Very sad end to her career. Thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure our listeners will love the fact you've been very honest about stuff and being very candid and authentic. And a genuine thank you for your service. Whether my listeners are blue, red, green or indifferent, I think they would all say, thank you. That's a long time to deal with some not pleasant stuff for the good of the community. So, Sir Gary, thank you for coming in and joining us.
Thank you, Stuart. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to In Conversation With, supported by Westcott's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors, a personal and local service that values relationships above all else. Westcott's, we're here. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Full audio and video production services for business podcasts and corporate events. Visit freshairstudios.com. Presented by Stuart Elford. Produced by Paul Philpott. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video production by Mark Stevenson. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Copyright Devon and Plymouth Chamber of Commerce and Fresh Air Studios Limited. All rights reserved.